Last Sunday night, we looked at Nehemiah and his ability to overcome the devious plans of those who opposed the building of the wall, and heard how he handled that, and how it was that they were able to overcome all the opposition, and there seemed to be a lot of it. And then we read, as it was coming to the end, chapter 6, that the wall is finished. And so what happens next? I want to read tonight from chapter 6, beginning at verse 15, and read through verse 3 of chapter 7, and talk about what happens next with the wall. Certainly, two things are on my mind. One is a celebration and a dedication of the wall, which was very significant and important. But the other thing also is all that Nehemiah does after the wall is completed to make sure that all the work that's been done is not done in vain, and particularly Nehemiah's interest and call for spiritual renewal, and what both he and Ezra do together in the next few chapters of Nehemiah tell us that the building of the wall, though that's the project they've been on and that's been Nehemiah's heart, that's not the ultimate end of what Nehemiah wants to accomplish. What he wants to see is spiritual revival and renewal and strength in Jerusalem. So let's read from chapter 6, reading at verse 15. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Ara, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam, son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds and then telling him what I said, and Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me. After the wall had been rebuilt and I had set the doors in place, the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed. I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most men do. I said to them, the gates of Jerusalem are not to be opened until the sun is hot. While the gatekeepers are still on duty, have them shut the doors and bar them. Also appoint residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their post and some near their own houses. Well, finally, the project is completed. Finally, after this time period that really isn't very long, this great project that was so, it required such cooperation and working together, teamwork, and the gathering of resources and coming up with a plan and following a plan, the project has finally come to an end. In all, this project has taken a total of 52 days, which to me is like a miracle itself. But I think how long it takes to do things and realize that however big that wall was, and we did have estimates of how high it was and how thick it was, and we certainly know from the description how long it was, that's an incredible amount of work that was done in 52 days. There were a lot of people. There are a lot of things going on. There's probably a lot of things going on that we don't know about because Nehemiah only gives us a small sketch of the whole project and what happened there. We certainly have a good outline, but I'm sure the work involved and the hours and all that went into securing the resources had to be an incredible project to be done in 52 days. Well, verse 15 also tells us the day and the month that the wall was completed. Looking back here at verse 15, we have, so the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul. 25th of Elul. If I'm pronouncing that name right, one of the Jewish calendar months. Elul is, I understand, the 12th month of the Jewish calendar. There's two different Jewish calendars. There's kind of like a ecclesiastical, a church calendar of events, and then there's the the civil calendar, calendar that they use on a regular day-by-day basis for business and all kinds of things. Well, Elul is the last month of the Jewish calendar year. And Elul has 29 days. You wonder, why am I reading about Elul? Well, I found out some interesting things about, I wonder, why does Nehemiah give us a date? Why is that significant? We know that in Ezra and Nehemiah, often dates were given for certain particular things that happened, and this is another one of them. Apparently Ezra, who we believe penned Nehemiah, dates were important, names were important, lists were important, details were important, but he does include the 25th of Elul. We know that Elul, the Jewish calendar, has 29 days, and it falls basically at the end of our summer, from about the halfway through August through the halfway of September. If you kind of try to equalize it to the Gregorian calendar and the calendar that we use, it's the end of summer, the last month basically of summer. It also, that day, the 25th of Elul, according to much Jewish writings and the oldest Jewish writings, many Jews still believe today that the 25th of Elul is also the first day of creation. And so the fact that it's included in this chapter would kind of make me think that there is this connection to the beginning of creation, to this very significant day and time when the wall was completed. The 25th of Elul is regarded as the first day that God created, and specifically that God created the heavens and the earth, and the first day of creation on that day. And so if you think of the 25th of Elul, and it has 29 days to it, and then you count the 6 days of creation, the 25th being the first, 26th, 27th, 28th, 29th is the fifth, the last day of the month, the last day of the Jewish year. The sixth day of creation is on the first day of the new year. And that, according to the Jews, was God's plan to create man on the first day of the year, of that celebration. And so there's a lot of significance in Jewish history to the 25th of Elul and this particular date of when the wall is completed. And I find that to be very interesting. Also, you may have heard this before or know that, but according to the Jewish writings, the first day of creation was in 3761 B.C. And they believe that on the 25th of Elul, in that year, God created the first day of creation. Not that every Jew believes that, and there are not other theories, but that is kind of the oldest and the traditional. And if you even go on the internet and you put what day do Jews believe that God created the heavens and the earth, they would put in the 25th of Elul in that year. So it's interesting to me that Ezra and Nehemiah gives that date. It shows that that date was important, and the link to the completion of the wall was important. It was significant and brought out that the wall was completed on the day, the celebration of the creation of the earth, believing that God was in that, and God brought about the completion of the wall on that day, and there was significance to that. So that's interesting. Whatever the case, it was a great accomplishment in so many different ways. It really is an incredible accomplishment of what had been done. After 170 years had gone by, the walls were broken down and nothing had been done. And in 52 days, when God put it in the heart of Nehemiah and he began to pray and he began to work and God opened the doors, you have 160, 170 years. And then in 52 days, the wall is built and completed. And so that's just another factor to me about how incredible it is. Also, we understand and we know that this is not the end of the opposition. We might like to think that when the wall was completed, everybody would say, all the enemies would say, oh, well, they got their wall completed. They can have their city and their nation back. But the opposition continued. And we read a little bit about the fear of the surrounding nations. When all of our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of God. So on one hand, you have the report that the nations around Israel had kind of come to the place of saying, okay, we believe that the God of Israel is in charge, and he has given these people the opportunity to have their country back and their city back, their capital back. So you have that on one end. But on the other hand, the people that were opposing the project on the inside, the opposition still continues. And when you think about it, the opposition to Jerusalem, the opposition to God's people, the opposition to the Jewish people will continue at this point and all through the rest of the intertestamental period. And of course, there's opposition when you come to Jesus' day to the Jewish people. And there's the Romans, for example. There's the history of the story of Daniel and the kingdoms. And the Jewish people never go very long without someone threatening them. And even as you turn the corner into the New Testament era, and then you trace the calendar of what's going on about the Jewish people from Jesus' day till now, you will find a steady dose of opposition and of antagonization toward them, and periods of how Jews have been horribly treated in the history since that time. And it's interesting to study that and what the Jews have gone through and how they have been opposed, and they've had century after century after century of opposition from different people. We can certainly think of the mid-1900s, not that long ago, really not that long ago at all, when the Jewish people went through such a horrible time of Holocaust. And if you really look in every century, they've been opposed by people who have lived in the land that God promised them. And you have the whole Palestinian problem and question today, and who should claim the land as their own, and the antagonism and the persecution between the Jews and others. Well, the opposition, so to say, did not go away when they built the wall. It's still there, and that will continue, and there will be many times of when the Jews will continue to deal, and some would say even today, as you look at Iraq, and you look at the nations around Israel that have opposed them, and even today, who knows what the news will be tomorrow about what they're dealing with, Israel, and how the book of the end times will come in the book of Revelations about God's people and the protection of God's people in the book of Revelations and how that's going to play out. But we know that the opposition will continue. But at this time, the wall is completed, and it's time for Nehemiah to look toward the future. And what does Nehemiah do? Is he knows his time is coming to an end. In fact, he's not going to stay around much longer. He's going to go back to Babylon and serve the king like he said he would do. Nehemiah said and asked the king for permission to go and to rebuild the walls and then go back. He didn't ask for permission to stay there and live there. In fact, the agreement with the king was he would come back and serve him, and that's what Nehemiah did. However, late in the book of Nehemiah, we find out that he did come back later also. We don't have much detail about that, but he is back in Israel, Jerusalem later, but his time is coming to an end, his part of the story as recorded in Nehemiah. So what does he do as his time is coming to an end and the wall had been completed? Number one, we know that Nehemiah is in charge at this point. You'd call him the governor or the mayor of Jerusalem or whatever it is, and people listen to him and respond to him, and he's been able, with God's help, to accomplish so much. So what does he do before he leaves? He appoints leaders. He appoints people to be in charge and to take charge of what's happening. It says, after the wall had been rebuilt, I had set the doors in place, the gatekeepers and the singers and the Levites were appointed. Those are spiritual people, the singers and the Levites, of course. That was important, that there were people that were there to lead the country, the city, the people in seeking God and worship. Then he says in verse 2, and I put in charge of Jerusalem my brother Hanani. You remember that name Hanani from chapter 1? It was his brother Hanani that had brought him news to Babylon of what was happening back in Jerusalem. Apparently, Hanani was a free man or whatever category, we're not sure, but apparently Hanani was able to travel back and forth, whereas Nehemiah had never been back until that moment. But Hanani had come and told Nehemiah, and then Nehemiah began to grieve and sob and pray and fast and ask God what he could do. Well, it's his brother Hanani who brought him the report that now is becoming the leader, as Nehemiah knows that he's going to go back. So he calls Hanani and puts him in charge of Jerusalem. And then it says, along with Hananiah, the commander of the citadel. So these two men, Nehemiah appoints to put them in charge. And as he is going to step back, and he's going to step away from the responsibility, and he's going to go back to Babylon. Interesting, Hananiah in the description. I love this description of this man, Hananiah, who I would kind of call the defense minister. Here it calls him, in verse 2, the commander of the citadel. I would say he was the man that was in charge of defending the city and organizing the people. And Nehemiah chose him. And why did Nehemiah chose him? It says at the end of verse 2, because he was a man of integrity and feared God more than most men do. He chose Hananiah because he was a man of integrity and he feared God. He had a heart that loved God and responded to God and was honest before God. And so Nehemiah tells the people, I've chosen the leaders here. Hanani, my brother, and Hananiah, the one who will be in charge of guarding the city. But also, Nehemiah is concerned about the safety of the city. And so, in addition to choosing the leaders, he also is involved in choosing strategy for what is going to happen and how the city is going to be protected, because he knows that the opposition isn't over. And there will be attacks. There will be people that will undermine. There will be people that will try to regain control. And so he's smart enough, and God's gifted him enough that he knows there needs to be very good strategy in place or policies in place. So verse 3, he tells us a little bit. He says, I said to them, the gates of Jerusalem are not to be opened until the sun is hot. While the gatekeepers are still on duty, have them shut the doors and bar them. Also appoint residents of Jerusalem as guards, some at their posts and some near their own houses. So Nehemiah is concerned about the ongoing safety of the city and what they do. So he puts those policies in place, and he's careful to follow up with the completion of the wall. I talked a few minutes ago about the neighbors and the neighboring countries how they were now saw Jerusalem as different than before. But also I mentioned how there were still enemies. And we get a little glimpse of some of what Jerusalem and the leaders would be up against when we read about the description in verse 17 and how there were alliances that were existent among the people and loyalties to certain factions and leaders. And these were complicating the plan in order for to get rid of the corruption, for example. And so Nehemiah knows that. And we have a 3-verse description of that. In those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah. Now, the nobles of Jerusalem are leaders, and they're still in touch with Tobiah. And Tobiah is stoking the fire of discontent and trying to stir up or foment trouble. And there's still a lot of people in Judah, it says. For many in Judah were under oath to him. Jerusalem, of course, is the capital of Israel. It's also the capital of Judah, the lion of the tribe of Judah. You have Jerusalem, and about 6 miles, you have Bethlehem, where David was born, and the city of David, where the Messiah would come from. And that whole area was Judah. And there were a lot of people that lived in Judah who were not loyal to the returnees, the exiles who came back, and they had their own system and their own plans, and many of them did not want the people to come back and to reclaim their ancestral lands. Of course, it would create all kinds of disruptions. So there is a lot of resistance, and people that lived in Judah, as the verse says here, who would not have liked that. And another factor is you have the intermarrying. Judah run oath to Tobiah. Tobiah was the son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Arah, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam, son of Berechiah. So you have Tobiah, who is one of the three specifically that's stirring up the conflict and trouble, and he is connected to people in Judah and families and clans, and Tobiah is like pulling the strings, and he's getting a hold of his family and saying, hey, you've got to do this, and you've got to fight that, and we're going to lose our control. And so you have this corruption, and you have the recognition by Nehemiah that that's what they were up against, and they would continue to have to deal with that. In Judah, it was one group of people. In Samaria, it was another. So we just read here about Judah, but we also know about the conflicts and the issues with the Samaritan leaders and how they didn't want Jerusalem to be strong. They wanted their capital to be in Samaria. They wanted their own temple in Samaria. They wanted their own priest in Samaria. They did not want to be connected and under the authority of the temple in Jerusalem. And so you have people from Judah who were still holding back and opposing. And then you had the Samaritan problem. And that problem will very much continue and be existent in Jesus' day. 350 to 400 years later, you have this issue with Samaritans. Lord willing, on Sunday, I'm going to talk about the woman at the well of Samaria. And just that story alone tells you a lot about there's still this issue with Samaria and people from Samaria and what they want and they choose and those things like that. But we have the intimidation that Tobiah is continuing to try to put on Nehemiah and others. Well, as we turn from this summary of some of the things that Nehemiah is doing, we also have over the next few chapters several little bits and pieces that are beautiful about Nehemiah's thoughts and plans about renewing worship now. The temple's been built, the city is secure, and being able to worship Yahweh God is so important to Nehemiah. And so we have several bits and pieces about worship and how important it is and how they're going to move to that. And again, Lord willing, next Sunday night, we're going to look specifically at some of the things of worship that are so special in this story. Before we get to that section, you have two lists of names. And we've talked before about all the lists of names in Ezra and Nehemiah and how they're significant and what they mean. Well, you have in chapter 7 and chapter 10 a list of long names. Just looking down at verse 8 of chapter 7, the descendants of Parosh, 2,172, of Shephatiah, 372, and so forth. So you have a list. It's significant. It's important. We know what that list is. This list in chapter 7 is a list of those who returned with Nehemiah from Babylon. So we have specific families or clans, these would be, of those that came back with Nehemiah. Again, this only happened 2 months ago. This list is not like it came years later. It's really a real follow-up to the first six chapters and the people that came back. This list is not necessarily an exhaustive list. By that, I mean that it doesn't necessarily include every clan or every family. And often lists from the Old Testament and the genealogies are written not to include every person, but to include the significance and the importance of families and clans and one generation to the next. When you look at this list as a whole and you count them, it's over 31,000 people that are chronicled by clan, by family in this list. So 31,000 people or so came from Babylon back to Jerusalem. You think of how many people that is. Those people who needed to find houses and lands, and many of them wanted to claim their ancestral homes. So you can imagine the organization that had to take place to do that. And we don't have much about that part of it, but this list gives us that. And then we have another list in chapter 10. Chapter 10 is a list of, it's a different kind of list. It's not a genealogy at all. The list in chapter 10 is a spiritual list. And it's a list, basically, of the families of the priesthood and those that are agreeing to, as spiritual leaders, the covenant of renewal with Nehemiah and the people. So chapter 10 is a different kind of list. It's Nehemiah saying to the priest and to the spiritual leaders, are you going to do what God calls you to do? Are you going to do what we agree on, the things that we're going to do? And so you have basically a description of the renewal of covenant that Nehemiah is fostering. And I said Nehemiah, but Esther too. Esther and Nehemiah now are going to be intertwined here of what they're doing. Nehemiah is giving attention to the spiritual health of the people, like Ezra has been doing as well. Ezra primarily has been giving attention to the spiritual condition of the people. Nehemiah has too, but he's done it through the building of the wall. Now he turns to more of the spiritual issue. You might say Nehemiah is the governor and Ezra is the preacher. But they come together now as they're calling for renewal. They're calling for these 31,000 and all the residents of Jerusalem and all the residents of Judea and all those around. They're calling them to come back to the renewal and to the what they had lost out on when they were carried away into Babylon 170 years before. And it began with the reading of the law in chapter 8. The first three verses describe how significant and important it was for the people to come together and to hear the word of the Lord. I'll just read a little bit of it. Verse 2, so on the first day of the seventh month, Ezra the priest brought the law before the assembly, which was made up of all men and women and all who were able to understand. He read it aloud from daybreak till noon as he faced the square before the water gate in the presence of the men and women and others who could understand it. And all the people listened attentively to the book of the law. So this process of renewal began for these people with hearing again the word of the Lord, the law of Moses, how they were to live, the covenant relationship with God. And that's very important. It's a part of the renewal. It's a part of the worship. And then a second part of that is the confession of the people. You go to chapter 9 and you read a very complete picture of confession of sins. The Israelites were called to remember how their forefathers had turned away from God and God had punished them. And so they confessed those sins, the sins of the past and the sins of the present. So they're hearing the book of the law of God and they're seeing where they're falling short, and they spend another quarter of the day in confession and in worshiping the Lord their God. There you have the people that are there in confession, confessing all that had separated them from God. There's this cleansing. There's this experience of getting it all out at this point and acknowledging the law of Moses and that they want to be those people again. There was a confession of sin. There's also the praise and prayer. The end there in verse 5, stand up and praise the Lord your God who is from everlasting to everlasting. And then the next really two chapters are prayer, praying out to God, confessing their sins, acknowledging the Creator, saying you are an awesome and a mighty God, and you are the giver of life, and you give life to everything. Verse 6 says, and the multitude of heaven worship you. It's worship, it's praise, it's prayer. All of these things are part of the renewal of these people and their relationship with God, and the intensity of prayer and the example we have of prayer. Now, these four things you might think, the reading of the law, the confession of sin, praise and prayer, are all leading to the people to the point that they are wanting to say, God, we want to be in covenant with you again. We want to follow you. We want to be your people again and you be our God. And so you come to this time or this moment that's being described of consecration, or whatever words you want to use it, where the people are coming saying, we want to be a part of this. We want to make the promise. We want to say, yes, we'll do what the law of Moses says. Yes, we will come back to obedience. And so at the end of chapter 9, you have the promises of the people of consecration. Chapter 9, and then the end of chapter 9, and there's verse 10, you have them promising certain things. And this whole list that I talked about in chapter 10 are the leaders saying, we promise we will do this. We're signing today. Verse 10, chapter 10, verse 1 says, those who sealed it were. And then it names the people: Nehemiah, Zedekiah, Seraiah, Azariah, Jeremiah, Pashur, Amariah, and on and on. In view of all this, 38 says, we are making a binding agreement, putting it in writing, and our leaders, our Levites, and our priests are affixing their seals to it. So Nehemiah said, we're starting with the spiritual leadership of this nation and these people. We are coming today and we're saying we will follow what God tells us to. They're making a new covenant, another a binding agreement, a covenant of relationship with God together, and they're signing it. And chapter 10 is the list of that. Let's look briefly in closing tonight of what they promise in chapter 10. What do they promise they're going to do in this renewed covenant and time, special time? Number one is they were promising to obey carefully the law of God. They're saying, we will obey what God tells us. We will learn the law of Moses again. We will memorize it like they did way back there. We will again know it. Part of this idea and the importance of following the law is what led to the emergence of the group called the Pharisees. This group of Jewish, sincere leaders who wanted to be so careful that they never again lost their obedience to the law of Moses. And so you have, over the next 300 years, the emergence of the Pharisees, who are the keepers of the law, and they have made a commitment as a people to obey the law of Moses and obey it completely. So you have such a strong sense of obedience to the law, and even up to the day of Jesus, you have this strong sense of, we've got to get it right, of doing exactly what God wants us to from the law of Moses. And that, of course, led at times to misunderstanding. It led to people, number one, obeying a law with their mind but not with their heart, or missing even the important parts of the law, so that Jesus would say later to the Pharisees, you've missed the weightier matters of the law. But it starts back to this time period where there was such an urgency and a fervor to obey the law of Moses. So then you have this creation of a school of scholars who commit themselves to memorize the law of Moses and apply it. And so they came up with what's called the Mishnah and other Jewish writings about taking the law of Moses and explaining everything about the law of Moses. And if you weren't sure what the law meant, then you have this group of scholars who would talk about it and they would define what it meant. For example, what is okay to do on the Sabbath day? Because Sabbath, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, was very important to them. So this group of scholars that later became the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and there were some other groups also, they would take the commandment of the Sabbath and then they would write a lot of rules about how you keep the Sabbath that weren't necessarily found in the law of Moses, but there would be descriptions of how far you could walk on the Sabbath without violating the Sabbath, and how much weight you were allowed to carry in your hands without violating the Sabbath. And there became more and more over time rules and regulations about the Sabbath, so that by the time you get to Jesus, it could be very oppressive to people, so much so that they missed part of it and they didn't realize that it was okay to even heal someone on the Sabbath. Somewhere along the way, they had decided that that would violate back to the law of Moses, so they had to stand against Jesus who had healed a man on the Sabbath, for example. But you can see where the beginning, it was good, and it was a part of their revival and their renewal. They wanted to carefully obey the law. The second thing that we find in chapter 10 is the call to stop the intermarrying, which was a big issue, a moral problem, a spiritual problem for the people that came back from Babylon, is the marrying of the Canaanites. Much as it was hundreds and hundreds, 500-600 years ago when they were marrying the Canaanites, and God told them to stop, and Moses told them, and Joshua told them to stop, and all those things. Intermarrying of those that did not worship Yahweh was a big issue. And it was a big issue here because there were these alliances and families that were connected who were not spiritually yoked together. And so the intermarrying continued to create issues and problems, and it would. And here they make the promise that we will not intermarry anymore. And we will stop that. And we will not do that anymore. And then you have the commitment, the promise to bring their tithes and offerings into the Lord. Sometimes this scripture probably isn't studied as much when we talk about tithing or offerings, but here in chapter 10, they make the promise that they will bring their tithes and their offerings into the Lord. And several are mentioned, what the purpose of them. Part of the offering was to take care of the temple. Part of the offering was to take care of people that were poor. There were to be contributions made at different ways at different times to take care of the first fruits, for example. So they're making this promise, this binding agreement, that they will come back to the laws and the traditions about the offerings and be sure to be giving in that way. And then one of the most important ones, and I've already talked about for a minute, is the importance of the Sabbath and how offensive it was back in the days when God warned the Israelites, if you do not come back to the Sabbath, I will destroy you. That was one of the three, I would say, primary things that God said if they would not change, then they would be destroyed. A second one would be idolatry, and the third one would be not taking care of the poor and the injustices that happened there. But the Sabbath was very important, and it became very important. And it was so important that through this intertestamental time, like I said, it led to very strong feelings in Jesus' day about the Sabbath. But it kind of goes back to this promise of honoring the Sabbath. Look at verse 31 of chapter 10 if you want to. When the neighboring peoples bring merchandise or grain to sell on the Sabbath, we will not buy from them on the Sabbath or on any holy day. Every seventh year, we will forego working the land and canceling the debts. And so you have this promise to honor the Sabbath, and that's important. Then the last one, categorizing them, is they promise to take care of the temple. You go to the very last verse of the chapter, and you have this statement, we will not neglect the house of our God. Now, whether that meant taking care of it physically or attending worship, probably it had to do with that primarily. And they were making the statement, we will worship our God. We will give attention again to what we have lost and we have missed out. And so you have these names, these people, all the way from Nehemiah to Bana in verse 27, the leaders, the Levites, the priests, and they're saying, we will do what's right. We make this promise before God. We promise today that we will do these five things. And that becomes kind of the kickoff then for the celebration. And when they make the commitment and they make the consecration, then you turn and you start to read of the celebration that comes to Jerusalem, the excitement, the joy, the great things that are going to happen. Again, you have lots of names over the next two chapters, chapter 11 and chapter 12. You have many more names of people that were involved in the whole process and how they are promising to live out in Jerusalem the law of Moses and all these things. And then you get to the end of chapter 12 after you have all these names and so many of them, and then you have the dedication of the wall and the great worship that takes place. And that's where we plan to pick up Sunday night as we come to kind of toward the end of Nehemiah. I'm thinking two more Sunday nights, next Sunday night, and then one more from Nehemiah's chapter 13 and all that happens there. It was a great, exciting time, a time of great revival and renewal. Any comments or thoughts or discussion? Anything at all? All right. Thanks for being here tonight. God bless. Good night.